So in reading the particularly complex and promising program for this colloquium, my impression was that the agenda was ultimately, and that would be very much IKKM style, the way I understand this institute, the agenda was very much to produce yet another, and yet another in a good way, symptomatology of the present, what's going on now, culturally, epistemologically, with an epistemological agenda that goes toward ontology. Not ontology as an overarching, totalizing paradigm, but in the sense of this metaphor I was using in the discussion, saying that if 20, 25 years ago the humanities were proud to be exclusively constructivist, I think, and you guys have made a large contribution there, their ontology now is conquering islands and a peninsula, and I think this is also inevitably and fortunately part of the agenda of this colloquium. In this sense, the title of the colloquium, which sees latency from a double view, is quite telling and quite interesting because I think it has an interesting ambiguity. There's on the one side, and you see it here, latency and the possible. And when I read latency and the possible, then I have the impression that latency and the possible, what is latent is acceptable. So what is latent is acceptable, is accessible, acceptable. You have a possibility to transform what is latent into possibilities, and you have a wealth of possibility. This would be one type of situation. But when I read latency of the possible, just changing one word, you have the impression that what is latent is not accessible, cannot be easily transformed into possibility, and you have a situation of scarcity of possibilities. For me, this ambiguous title with these two meanings in tension was the symptom of a productive intellectual uncertainty, of a productive intellectual insecurity. And I say that as a word of praise because, I mean, maybe a little bit in the spirit of what Bernhard said, I think colloquia are only worthwhile if they start out from a position of insecurity and uncertainty. I mean, colloquia were just supposed to illustrate what you already know, are not only not worth one's time, but also not worth taxpayers' money. Now, similar to such uncertainty is my title for this colloquium. When I reread it, I mean, we are in an age where one has to announce titles for contributions to colloquia like 8 months ahead of time. Then one does a title, forgets the title, and 2 weeks before the colloquium, one looks at it. And I looked at it and said, oh, that's a weird title. This is like I want to do everything that's epistemologically possible. So let me explain that title a little bit, and you have probably a first impression of what my agenda will be. So the main title is, quote, everything possible, / quote, no latency left. And this expression refers to what we call and use sometimes as a description of our present when we say a field of contingence. And I will not say contingency because in the first place, contingency is not really the correct translation of the German contingence. And as contingency in English, which is contingent upon, it doesn't work. So I will say at Weimar and in Goethe's house, field of contingence, that's weird. But I think everybody's going to understand what I mean by field of contingence. Now, when I'm saying contingence, I mean simply that we are confronted with the world in a way that each intentional object does not only have one and only one and one necessary meaning or one function. Potentially, in a situation of contingency, each intentional object can have an infinity of meanings, of functions, of uses, etc. But we say field for a very specific reason, because normally when we talk about contingence in this sense, we believe that a certain horizon of contingence, a horizon in which the world is polyperspective, is not eindeutig, is surrounded by necessity on the one side, and on the other side, impossibility. I mean, this is not only my impression, this is, for example, a quote by Luhmann in which Luhmann tries to interpret Hegel. So field of contingency, in the center you have this horizon of things that appear to be contingent, but they are therefore field limited by necessity on the one side and impossibility on the other side. Now, when I'm saying a universe or everything is possible, I say universe of contingence, then I refer to a present situation, and by present I mean something like the last decade, and I refer to global or Western culture, in which I believe there is a tendency to dissolve the side of necessity. Instead of being necessary, things become also possible, but I'm also referring to the side of impossibility. So what used to be necessary becomes possible, and what used to be impossible becomes possible. I will later on illustrate that, so that we find ourselves in a situation of universal contingence, in a situation of universal contingence, and that would precisely be a situation in which there is no latency left. Everything is possible, no latency left. Is that clear? This is basically, with this title, I'm referring, it's a hypothesis, a first hypothesis. I try to describe our present-day situation, not only the situation of intellectuals. We are in a situation where the center, which used to be a field of contingence, is no longer surrounded by the impossible or by the necessary everything. There's nothing left. Everything is contingent, and everything is transformed into a possibility. Now, the subtitle says, "The apocalyptic light of our broad present in a universe of contingence." Now, this refers to a hypothesis that I've been trying out in these two books on latency that Bernhard was kind enough to mention. I basically believe that situations of latency, and I will not define them now, that situations of latency always produce different Stimmungen. It is actually thanks to a Stimmung that you know that something is latent, because by definition you cannot see which is latent. So only because something happens, something is in the air, there's a Stimmung, you can talk about a situation of latency. Now, if it's maybe plausible for you too, that situations of latency are producing different Stimmungen depending on what is latent, my second question is, if we have a situation of universal contingence, where there is no latency left, what Stimmung would that produce? And the answer is already in the subtitle, but I will try to argue that. I believe it is a situation that is a Stimmung that one could characterize, maybe that's a little bit hysterical, by the word apocalyptic. Definitely it's not a positive Stimmung. Okay, so this is in the center of what I try to do. I try to describe our present-day situation as not just as a field of contingence, but as a universe of contingence. That's my first thesis, and I try to see what the consequences are. This will be developed in five parts. I start with the late 18th century, because I think in, let's say, early modern history, it is the late 18th century where for the first time contingence was presenting itself. But this contingence was dealt with in very different ways by very two different worldviews. I think one can describe, and this is what I will do, the so-called historicist worldview, das historische Weltbild, as a worldview that absorbs, that neutralizes the problem of contingence. But there is another worldview that a Russian student of mine at Stanford called, I love it, the underbelly of enlightenment. I mean, you have to imagine this very ugly underbelly, where contingence stays. So that's a different worldview, and I think that is also an inheritance of the 18th century. Second point, I believe that this underbelly of enlightenment, the situation in which contingence is not taken care of, not neutralized, not absorbed, comes back very strongly in the mid-20th century, and that I will try to describe. It comes back very strongly in the mid-20th century, but it comes back first as a field of contingence. So not in the radical form, rather in the harmless form. In the third part, I will then describe how during the second half of the 20th century, indeed quite recently, this field of contingents got transformed in what I've already been describing into a universe of contingents. And my fourth part is the question, what Stimmung does this universe of contingents produce? What is our Stimmung, existentially speaking, in such an epistemological environment? And finally, and maybe this is the provocation, really, this is the risk for thinking. Normally, when intellectuals or people who call themselves in German Wissenschaftler are confronted with situations of latency, they feel one obligation to transform the latent into the patent, to make an etymological play, into something evident. I mean, latent is bad for intellectuals. But I will finish my argument today with the question whether what we need today in an environment of universal contingents would be not more latency, whether it would not be our self-assignment to produce more latency instead of transforming latency in the possible. But it looks like everybody has understood that, so I could actually stop and we could go to the graveyard, right? But no, I won't, because it wouldn't be a keynote. Okay, now before I really get going, but really get going, and Bernhard should have mentioned as an 11th point, I'm the one speaker who uses one-third of each lecture for introductory remarks, so don't think it's going to last 3 hours now. The following, I mean, the first one is an apology, and this must be old age. For me, whether you like this lecture or not, it was very important to confront myself with this question. I mean, for me, in a certain way, it's a breakthrough, either towards death and retirement, if it's very bad, or towards something very important, but it matters to me a lot. Nevertheless, there are certain elements in that lecture that some of you who read my stuff are already familiar with. I mean, this is old age. At age 66, I'm just not capable, not for a question of time, for a question of brain, to produce something completely new for each lecture. So certain things I've said, for example, at Wesleyan 18 months ago, but this is not more than 10%. Nevertheless, I want to apologize for that. Secondly, and I always get this criticism, I mean, the way you describe our present is too gloomy. And I find that bad. I mean, I get this argument both in the US and in Germany, not so much in South America and Eastern Europe. I really don't think it is an obligation of intellectuals. It is an obligation of intellectuals to draw a beautiful picture of the world. I mean, and then people say, but Sepp, you are having a good time. You look like you're having fun. Well, to tell you the truth, I'm having fun if people let me speak. I like that a whole lot. You should never pay me for that. I like that a whole lot. But I am, Ricky could confirm that, I am basically existentially very pessimistic, and I'm very pessimistic about this present situation that I'm trying to describe. So bear with me, and you know, we won't have time for a discussion today, for an official discussion. Okay, now I get going, and the warning, I mean, make this same joke always, but at this point you look at me like you're interested in what I have to say. And that is dangerous because that makes me very baroque. I will tell anecdotes, I will repeat things, I will insist on things, etc., etc. If I had, I would do PowerPoint. It's going to be very long, so if you want it to be short, then look at me like you are really bored. And then I get embarrassed, I would skip things, and so forth, and so forth. Okay, part one, the emergence of contingents. And this is the part where some of you will know, not everything, I think, but some of the arguments. For me, the great epistemological innovation of the second half of the 18th century was when the predecessors of us intellectuals today, I would much rather be an intellectual than a Geisteswissenschaftler than a Wissenschaftler, when our predecessors, who called themselves in the 17th century philosophes, les philosophes, transformed themselves from a first-order observer, to quote Luhmann, a Cartesian outside observer and interpreter of the world, into habitual second-order observers, into people who could not help observing themselves in the act of world observation. I think this is the central epistemological event Can one explain why it happens? I don't even try that. It just happened. It's not that people decided all of a sudden to become second-order observer. Now, this transformation, philosoph intellectuals being second-order observers, had two amazingly important consequences. One consequence is that a second-order observer quickly discovers that each of his worldviews, each of his interpretations, depends on her point of view, and she quickly discovers that there is always a potential infinity of point of views. And that means that for each object of reference, you have a potential infinity of point of views. And that leads, in the late 18th century, to an existential crisis situation that I would like to describe as epistemological horror vacui. People were really scared that if there's a potential infinity of representation for each object of reference, that there may not be a self-identical object of reference. If you think I just made that up, I give you one example, and that is so-called Kant-Krise in Heinrich von Kleist. Yeah? When Kant read only a couple of pages, probably of the Third Critique, we don't know really what it was, he got scared precisely by that point. And he said something in letters in his diary, well, maybe the world, the real world, does not exist. I will never read philosophy again, which was good because he would probably not have been a good philosopher, and he's my favorite German classic author. So we get this point. Epistemological horror vacui. Perspectivism, you may call it. But you can also call it contingens. The world appears as contingens. The other problem is that a second-order observer rediscovers that there are two levels of world observation. A Cartesian observer only has experience as world appropriation. That means world appropriation by concepts. But a second-order observer discovers that there are also the senses, the body, and this makes for another level, another dimension of world appropriation, what we may call perception, world appropriation by the senses. And the second problem is there a compatibility or not between world appropriation by concepts, experience, and world appropriation through the senses? Now, these two problems, in the emergence, because that's what I'm describing, of what we call das historische Weltbild. I call it the historicist worldview in English. It would not be das historistische Weltbild, of Deutsch, das historische Weltbild. Found two quick solutions. The problem of compatibility finds a very quick solution. It gets bracketed. You can tell that in German idealism, for example, think of somebody like Fichte, but also think of Hegel, the central side of the world just does not appear anymore. Whereas the perspectivism, the epistemological horror vacui, the contingens, has a more creative or productive solution. And that solution would lie in a change from a mirror-like principle of world representation, one description of each object of reference, to a narrative principle of world representation. From the early 19th century on, when people ask themselves, what is Weimar? They will tell the history of Weimar. If people ask themselves, what is a camel, not a cigarette, but the animal, they will tell the evolutionary proto-Darwinian history of the camel. And if people ask themselves, what is the spirit, then they have to go by the surname of Hegel and write the phenomenology of the spirit, which, if you have read it, you know, is a narrative. Now, why is a narrative a solution of contingents? Or why does narrative observe contingents and perspectivism? My thesis is because a narrative pattern allows you to organize, to absorb a plurality of world representations. Now this is exactly what Michel Foucault calls historisation des êtres, historicization of things. This becomes the basis of what, and I think he was the first, Reinhard Koselleck, described and historicized as the historisches Weltbild. And I will briefly remind you mainly of Koselleck's description, tell you what this is all about. This is a worldview in which we always believe that we leave the past behind ourselves, in which secondly the future appears as an open horizon of possibilities from which we can choose, and in which between that past and this future that we enter, present appears to be an imperceptibly short moment of transition. Present has no substance. This is a quote from Baudelaire, painter of modern life from 1858. So this was Kozelek. I add two further features. I believe that this imperceptibly short present of transition becomes the place, the habitat, of the Cartesian self-reference, of the subject, capital S, of humans as consciousness. It is in the present that, based on experience from the past, humans choose among the possibilities of the future. This is what Max Weber later on will call an action, and this is what, since the early 19th century, considered to be specifically human. And finally, the historical worldview implies that time is a necessary agent of change, that there are no phenomena, it may go very slow, may go very fast, that can resist transformation in time. Okay, so this is the worldview in which the problem of contingenz, the Felderkontingenz, perspectivism, is neutralized, is taken care of. And this is a worldview which around 1830 is so highly institutionalized, is the condition for early socialism, for early capitalism, is the condition for philosophy of history and for evolutionism, that people begin to confuse it with time in it by itself and with the correct worldview in it by itself. This is how you have to see the world. But, and this is the book I'm presently working on, it started actually with a seminar in which my friend Karl Ellerbrock participated in this very room. It was what is called a master class or something here in Weimar 3 years ago. There is another worldview coming out of the 18th century, rather peripheral, but I would not say repressed or something like that, in which contingenz is not neutralized. And the three protagonists of the late 18th century, who I believe embodied this other worldview that was not historicist, that I'm dealing with, are Diderot, and this converges with an intuition that Vittoria had, are Diderot, Goya, Lichtenberg, and also Mozart. So that will be the subtitle of the book. That I already know. It will be Diderot, Goya, Lichtenberg, Mozart. A pretty nice lineup if it was a baseball team. We were talking, Ethan and I, about lineups. Especially Mozart number 3 I like because it was so short. Lichtenberg was a dwarf. Imagine 3 and 4. It would be quite interesting. Now, in this worldview precisely, the transformation of contingenz into necessity does not happen. Think of Diderot's most famous novel, Jacques le Fataliste. Jacques le Fataliste is the one who always says, c'est la faute de la fatalité, this was necessary. And this is why, in that book, to make a long story short, Jacques le Fataliste is the idiot. Yeah? I mean, you think because he's the servant, and this is 18th century, he has to be the good guy. No, he is the stupid, idiotic guy. This is a worldview in which the world appears as a field of contingenz, and there's no deductive way to neutralize that. You have to make a judgment. This worldview of contingenz is related to judgment in the Kantian sense. Secondly, if you make a judgment, then you can only refer to singularities. Judgment cannot be general judgments. You can only refer to a singular case. I think this is the reason why Diderot became really the founder of modern art criticism with his salons. And if you read these salons, the interesting thing is that they never say anything general. Diderot reacts individually with judgment to one and yet another and yet another and yet another painting. Thirdly, in this worldview that is not repressed but remains peripheral, the problem of the compatibility between perception and experience is not bracketed, like in the historicist worldview. And this is the reason why somebody like Diderot, and without using the concept Goya, for example, if you think of the Caprichos or Horrores de la Desastres de la Guerra, why they are fascinated with what Diderot called materialism. Why he wrote something like La Lettre sur les Aveugles, trying to imagine what would be a a perception of the world based on all the senses minus vision, or la lettre sur les sous, minus audition, and so forth and so forth. And the fourth point, in that worldview, the human self-reference is not Cartesian, is not purely spiritual, but the positive self-reference always includes the body, includes the senses, proof being Rameau's nephew. This fantastic dialogue that people call a novel, that Goethe in this house translated immediately after reading it into German. Do you know the story? And then the French original got lost because Diderot didn't have to care about publication anymore. And for 100 years, the French classic, Le Neveu de Rameau, was based on a retranslation by Goethe because there was no French origin. And then they found in the late 19th century the manuscript, the bouquinist. They had to say that in the Goethe house. Anyway, Le Neveu de Rameau is in dialogue with the philosophe. And you think, oh, the philosophe, that's Diderot, he's the smart guy. No, the philosophe is absolutely stupid and banal, no risk for thinking at all. And the interesting person is the one who has a physical self-reference, who stinks and shouts and uses four-letter words that I cannot say in the house of Goethe, etc., etc. And finally, in this worldview, and I think Diderot is proof, I would say there is no interest in historicity. Yeah, transformation, or can things resist transformation in time, is just not something that interests Diderot, Goya, Lichtenberg, Mozart, and so forth. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying this is the good worldview and the other one is the bad one. The institutionalized one is the historicist world with das historische Weltbild that neutralizes Kontingenz, but Kontingenz as a possibility was always around. So the underbelly of enlightenment was always around. I mean, Nietzsche, for example, would definitely be a philosopher that fits rather to this other worldview, including Kontingenz, jenseits von Gut und Böse. The same would be true in a very different way for Nietzsche's greatest admirer, for Heidegger. Part two, and don't fear, part two, three, four, five will be much shorter than this introduction. Part two, I believe that you can see how the historicist worldview enters in a crisis in the mid-20th century. I mean, during the 19th and early 20th century, it is so heavily institutionalized that people think that is the correct worldview. That is time in it by itself and not a historically specific reconstruction, a construction of time. And I give you one reference for the crisis of the historical worldview, famous book, famous author, 1951, Albert Camus, L'Homme Révolté. There's one leitmotif, both in the beginning and at the ending. He says he finds it immoral to ask people to invest in the present, not money, to invest effort in the present into a future that people pretend is prognosticated. So, I mean, he doubts that you can ever prognosticate the future. He doubts that you can have a historicist worldview. And even if it were intellectually possible, he finds it immoral. This is the moment, of course, in which Camus quits the French Communist Party, in which everybody until 1968, when I was a second-year student, you had to say Camus was horrible because he was not a communist. Because he draws this conclusion, it's not so much against communist politics, it is against the historicist worldview. I think, however, the most important crisis here for the central institutionalization of the historicist worldview is 1973. This is the book in which Jean-François Lyotard's worst book, but most efficient book, La Condition Postmoderne, appears, and at the same time, and they didn't know of each other, Hayden White's Metahistory. I mean, this will be the high point of constructivism. Yeah? The argument of Lyotard's book is precisely a critique of what he calls les grands récits, the master narratives. And the critique of the historicist worldview is to say, no, a narrative does not absorb contingents. Because, of course, you can tell an infinity of narratives for each event of reference, for each object of reference. So contingence, perspectivism, is not absorbed through historicism. It took people 150 years or 170 years to discover that. The first reaction is neo-historicism, is what Lyotard calls heterotopology, is this constructivist happiness. Okay, then we can write 20,000 stories about each object of reference, and isn't that fun? Yeah, and I'm going back a little bit to the previous discussion. This was fun for 3.5 years, and then it got really, really boring, among other things, because you had no discussion, by the way, because there had been a tragic or comical misunderstanding. As Bernard was kind enough to mention my book in 1926. In 1926 is, of course, by no means a neo-historicist book in that sense. No, it is meant as a polemic against neo-historicism. I, of course, know that I will not objectively describe that year, but yes, this book is driven by the effort to describe as objectively, asymptotically speaking, as it gets. So is that clear? This is the crisis year. This is the year which, at least among intellectuals, makes the historicist worldview problematic. And I will not say now the tradition from this Diderot worldview comes in, but what establishes itself as intellectually acceptable, I would say, in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s, centrally, is no longer the historicist worldview, but is precisely a view of the world as a field of contingents. A view of the world as a field of contingents. So things are basically polyvalent. Lyotard says, this is very beautiful, what used to be the specificity of the aesthetic judgment in Kant, namely that you have to judge without stable quantitative or qualitative criteria, has now become a general condition. So contingents of the world as a field and judgment, you have to judge in each case, has become a general condition. Now this, a worldview where the central horizon is contingents, surrounded by necessity on the one side, things that are considered to be necessary on the one side, and impossibility of the other side, this worldview still contains a lot of latency. Because I think precisely beyond latency is the virtual. But that virtual is not really accessible. You have a hard time to imagine what that would be. And on the other side, I think the impossible is not a series of objects. The impossible precisely, if you allow me for that metaphor, is like a cushion of latency. So this is a worldview where contingents is in the center, but where you have two broad margins, two broad dimensions, necessity and impossibility of latency. Third point, and you see my second point was much shorter than the first point. The third point is even shorter, and then, okay, man. At some point you will have dinner, I promise. Third point is, this is the dramatic point, so to speak, the intensification of this situation, I think, in the last 20 years perhaps, I mean, cannot just chronologically say from then on, but I think the process I will now describe is something that started in the 1990s, became visible in the 1990s. I think in our everyday today, we are no longer living in the historicist chronotope. In our everyday today, I think we live in a construction of time that I have tried to describe, faute de mieux, I have no good name for it, as our broad present, unsere breite Gegenwart. And in a contrast to the historicist worldview, I would say this is a worldview where the future is not an open horizon of possibilities to choose from, but the future is occupied by threats that come towards us. We may slow them down by doing very correct Trennmüll, but global warming will happen in the end. I don't know whether it's really going to happen. I'm just saying this is how most people wake up and feel before they brush teeth and after they brush teeth. Secondly, it is a worldview in which we no longer leave the past behind ourselves, but in which a somehow aggressive pastness inundates the present. largely, but not exclusively, due to electronic storage possibilities. There is nothing we can forget. And very soon, every document accessible on the planet will be accessible and available at each laptop screen. It is thirdly, and this is important, a construction of time in which the present is no longer an imperceptibly short moment of transition, but an ever-broadening present of simultaneities. Everything is in the present. So you could say there's an affinity between the present of that construction of temporality and contingence. Everything is there in this present. Fourthly, if it was possible to associate a Cartesian self-reference, humans as subjects, as consciousness, with the imperceptibly short moment of transition as a present, and if we now have a present with a different structure, that makes it plausible why we have been so desperately trying for the past quarter century, both philosophically, but also in our everyday life, think of dieting, think of jogging, think of sports, think of watching sports, for Ethan and me, to recuperate the body. So the self-reference that goes with this construction of time is no longer a Cartesian self-reference. And finally, this is a construction of temporality where exceptions from time being a necessary agent of change become thinkable. Now, there is an affinity between this construction of temporality and a situation of contingence. A situation where you always have too many things to choose from. That would be another everyday description of contingence. The first one being, according to the logic of the chronotope of the broad present, of the time construction of the broad present, the old construction of time, the historicist construction of time, will not get eliminated. Nothing gets eliminated. So that today, we don't choose, but we oscillate between a historicist worldview and a broad present worldview. I mean, if you want to get a PhD in history, you better be on the side of the historicist worldview. You will not get a worldview if you don't believe in that. Or if you are on an election campaign. Yeah? Obama's Yes, We Can of the 2008 election campaign is precisely a historicist worldview. Yes, we still can, despite skepticism, choose from the possibilities of the future. You get my point? Already, the co-presence of two different constructions of temporality is a situation of contingence. But above all, and this is the central point, and now I come back to what I said in the very introduction, in this situation, in the situation of our present of the last 15 years of the last decade, I believe that increasingly within the present of the new chronotope, this present of simultaneities, what used to be a field of contingence has been unlimited, has been transformed into a universe of contingence. Yeah? What used to be necessary has been degraded, downgraded to being a possibility. And what used to be impossible has been upgraded to be a possibility. Now everything is possible. So that you don't think I'm only making this abstract place, let me give you two examples. We used to consider the sex into which you were born as necessary, as fate. You could hate it, but if you were born with certain genitals, or if you were a hermaphrodite, that was your fate, that was necessary. Now today you can contemplate transsexual surgery. I mean, that is a gain of freedom, but you get my point. This would be an example for something formerly necessary being transformed in a possibility. And if there was one concept that we used to consider as emblematically impossible, it was human immortality. Most of you will know that today, human immortality, physical immortality, has become an assignment for medicine. It is not possible yet, but it is no longer considered to be absolutely impossible. So it is something whose possibility You may think, and according to whom you talk at a medical school today, people will think, you know, no, that will be possible. The question is whether people want it. You get my point? I mean, these are just two examples. So you get my point? We are no longer in a situation where we have a center part of our worldview is contingent, surrounded by necessity and impossibility, but tendentially we are living in a highly complex worldview in which everything is on this same level of being a possibility where, and this was the title, or is the title of my talk, there is no latency left. Now, what would be the Stimmung associated with a situation, I mean, I'm exaggerating, I'm talking in a Hegelian way, but in a situation where tendentially nothing is latent. Everything formerly latent has been transformed into a possibility. One could, of course, say, well, this is a gain of freedom. We have more choices, that is positive. But I actually think, and hence the word apocalyptic in my title, that the Stimmung is a Stimmung of profound existential insecurity. We know everything knowable, and we still do not know what humans are all about. We still cannot guarantee the survival of humans as a species, and so forth. And at each given moment, we have too many choices. This universe of contingents is existentially too much. To give you one obvious example, this is the condition, this is the Stimmung that I associate with the burnout syndrome. Because objectively, once again, in the quote-unquote global world, most people are working considerably less hours and are in a considerably better financial situation, maybe in the U.S. not than 20 years ago, but 50 years ago. And yes, and yet depression, bipolarism, burnout syndromes are so tough, and I think this has to do with what I describe as a universe of contingents. I think to add one component to the description of the situation of universe of contingents, this explains this strange and surprising desire of people to want to be part of a large collective body, to want to be part of a mass. I mean, mass, Basse used to be a negative word. All of a sudden it has become a positive, not word, but a positive desire. I like to borrow a concept from very early Christian theology, I mean pre-Protestant Catholic theology, where the church called itself Christ's mystical body. And I'm talking of mystical bodies. For example, wherever the Pope appears and reads Mass at open air, a million people appear, and we know demographically that not even half of those people even know what the Pope is, what a Mass is. They want to be there. But this is the same with public viewing. Actually, more than half of the people who go to a public viewing event close to the Brandenburg Gate, for example, want to be part of a collective body and are not so terribly interested in that game. I think this was the Arabic Spring that went in many political directions, but people wanted to be there together. These were the youth protests in Brazil in the year before the Soccer World Cup, the Confederations Cup. Nobody knew what they wanted, and then when the government started negotiating with them, they didn't know themselves what they wanted. They wanted to be together, and this, I think, is Maidan in Kiev. Yeah, and I'm proud to say I was in Kiev giving a talk the day before yesterday, developed precisely this thesis, and people found that convincing because there was no political will. There were centrifugal political wills in Maidan, but people wanted to be there. They wanted to be together. They wanted to abandon the individuality which confronts them with a universe of contingency. They wanted to be part of a collective body whose movement is rhythm. They wanted to be part of a collective body that had no will, that had no specific structure. Now, final consideration. It's not been all that long, so. But you look at me friendly. I thought it would last much longer. Maybe I'm hungry myself, so whatever. Fifth part. If, in a way, counter to the promises of enlightenment. Enlightenment promises the more you know, the better you will feel. The more latency you transform, once again, I apologize for the word, into patency, into something that's obvious, into something that's a possibility, the better you feel. Now, that is clearly not the case. So the question is whether we should not think about creating a world in which there would be more latency, whether what is to be said about latency, not so much epistemologically, but existentially today, is would there be ways, cultural ways, ways of education, political ways, to go back to more latency? This is my final discussion, so this will take me another 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. I mean, and this goes together, I think, with certain other desires. For example, there is a huge desire today for epiphanic moments, for epiphanic events, which would have the possibility to retransform something that is a possibility into a certainty, into something that appears all of a sudden necessary. There is a desire, and this is what I would like to develop now, to interact out of our universe of contingents, to interact with a layer, a horizon of our everyday that would not be completely transformed latency, that would not be completely possibility, that would not be completely overcomplexity. Is that understandable? So if there is too much possibility, too much complexity, if the transformation of latency into possibility has been too successful, so to speak, then the question is, don't we have a desire to be surrounded by a layer, by a dimension that would be more constituted by latency? Now, interestingly, I think Martin Heidegger, in his philosophical trajectory, was twice confronted with such a situation. And I'm now making at least one quite precise reference. And the precise reference is his Vorlesung from 1929, Fundamental Concepts of Metaphysics, which had remained a Vorlesung until 1979. It was 1979. It was published as a book in the complete works. But it was never published during his lifetime. Now, what is the self-assessment, the self-assignment of this book? So Heidegger says pretty much in the introduction, I have written Being and Time, Sein und Zeit, published in April 1927. I have written and assessed the ontology of Dasein, the ontology of human existence. And now the question is, what is the whole? W-H-O-L, das Ganze. What is the larger whole of which Dasein, human existence, is a part? And he actually, unbelievably, if you haven't read the book, the word that he uses for this feeling is Heimweh. He says there's a nostalgia, there's a Heimweh for something larger that we want to construct. Now, in this Vorlesung, which is in the transcript in German, 500 pages, he tries above all to use the concept of world in a pseudo-constructivist way. It reminds you of constructivism. He said, well, we interact and we constitute something of which we want to be part, and he doesn't seem to be satisfied with it. I mean, this is a transcript of a Vorlesung. You can say how he tries things. I mean, Heidegger would always intentionally prepare his Vorlesung from hour to hour. This somehow doesn't work. And at the end, in the last two Vorlesungen, he proposes for the first time the concept of Seinsgeschichte. Seinsgeschichte is the larger context. I mean, it doesn't develop it much. Seinsgeschichte is the larger context of which Dasein, human existence, is a part. This is how this Vorlesung ends. Now, what interests me about that and why I have bothered you with this Heidegger recap is the following. Seinsgeschichte, precisely, would be a horizon of Dasein, a horizon of human existence full of latency. Yeah? Seinsgeschichte, if one can express it this way, consists in events of truth. But it is being, so to speak, that decides to unconceal itself. Humans cannot trigger that. Now, it remains latent why and when being, quote unquote, decides to unconceal itself. That's the first latency. Second, and this is the meaning of this famous sentence from the Spiegel interview, nur ein Gott kann uns noch helfen. Although being decides itself to unconceal itself, it can only unconceal itself in the presence of Dasein. So Dasein has to be there as a catalyst for unconcealment of being to happen. Why this is so, Heidegger never says. It just has to be there. And he goes so far to say that to be there in order to be the catalyst of unconcealment of being as an event of truth is die Schuld, the sense of debt, what you owe to the history of being. And then finally, hence, history of being, there are certain chronological moments for Heidegger, obviously ancient Greece and his own present time, where unconcealment of being is more likely or less likely to happen. That is also not explained. You get my point. History of being can function as a horizon, as a description of a horizon of human Dasein that is actually permeated with latency. That was not Heidegger's intention, but I find it interesting, and I find it interesting that maybe therefore, for some of us, certainly for me, it has a certain appeal. Yeah, this is a horizon for the everydayness of Dasein, a horizon that remains secular, and a horizon that does not overload you. There are certain things you have to do, and you will not know why, but you have to be there. Now, and I insist on secular. I think secular is important. Now, Heidegger found himself in a similar situation, existentially much more aggravated, but intellectually, epistemologically similar, in immediately after World War II. I mean, I'm referring as a document to the first text he published. He published after World War II, and this is the letter on humanism, the Humanismusbrief, brief from 1947. There he is again in the same situation, so to speak. He says, I mean, this is, I'm almost literally quoting from Humanismusbrief, we know everything that can be known about humans, so there is nothing left to be transformed from latency into evidence, into knowledge. We know everything, and yet it would be an illusion that we can ever know enough to guarantee the survival, the continuity of humankind. I mean, this was an old-fashioned theological thought that we thought that our intellectual mental equipment would be just powerful enough to guarantee our survival. No, we know everything we can possibly know. Maybe we can push it a little bit further, but it doesn't help existentially. Now, this will then trigger in Heidegger's work after 1947 a second tonality, a second style of Seinsgeschichte that I personally like much less, because all of a sudden there are all gods hopping around there, die Götter müssen uns helfen, and there's this very weird Gefiert, the fourfold, I mean, that I find so schwarzwaldbäuerisch that even I, being a Heidegger fan, can not tolerate it. Whereas this relatively early version of Seinsgeschichte, I'm not recommending that to you as a consolation in your existential temptations, but that seems to be an interesting discourse that reintroduces latency in our collective and individual existence. And I want to finish with a double question, and both questions are not rhetorical questions. The first question is whether preconsciously and pre-intentionally this situation may be the reason why some of the truly great protagonists in the humanities in recent years have produced a discourse that I like to characterize, and I don't mean in the critical way, as mythological. And of course, I mean, you know to whom I'm referring. I'm referring, for example, to Friedrich Kittler. He has been criticized for that, and when I was describing that as positive, all the Kittler-Jugend hates me ever since. There are certain people who will not speak with me anymore because I was saying, I mean, Friedrich Kittler was not above all, but among other things, a very talented mythological author. Now, could that be positive? Could that horizon that Kittler gave in these books on Greek antiquity to his project of a history of media, could this horizon that contains latency, that precisely does not answer all the questions, could this just be interesting? And just as a bibliographical reference, some of you know him, I think in a very different style, something similar is true for my Stanford colleague Robert Harrison, who just published a couple of weeks ago his latest book at Chicago University Press under the title of Juvenescence. And the basic thesis is that anatomically and physiologically speaking, humans are young animals. Humans are young animals, and that explains partly why they are different from other animals. Now, why we would be young animals? That would be a question that he leaves latent. You get my point? So these would be discourses coming out of the humanities that are not programmatically mythological, but that begin to provide latency instead of transforming latency in evidence. And the question is whether it would be irresponsible to make this not the only, but one of the discourses, one of the considerations, one of the challenges of the humanities of the future. And I'm very, very grateful for your attention.